This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 23rd of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Welcome to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. I have two guests for you today. Marie Kondo, the self-confessed crazy tidying fanatic, is currently occupying the first and second slots of the New York Times bestseller list with her two books on how tidying your living space can magically transform your life. My second guest, Alexander Hemon, was born in Sarajevo. Whilst visiting Chicago in 92, Sarajevo came under siege. He never went home. He's based in the United States and has been widely lauded for his English language publications. We'll start off with a couple of books written in Japanese. The life-changing magic of tidying has sold 5 million copies around the world. It's been on the New York Times bestseller list for weeks and weeks, taking the top spot again this week, where it's been joined by the illustrated companion volume, Spark Joy, going straight in at number two. Both works are by Marie Kondo, the self-described crazy tidying fanatic, who spoke to me in Japanese, her words here translated by Ree Hunter. Marie, you've been called the Beyoncé of tidying. You have a huge global following, and you've been named one of Time magazine's 100 most influential people in the world. Where did all this start for you?
This spark you mentioned, the spark joy I always talk about, came from my mistake. Actually, when I was student still, I was focusing on discarding at that time, because I thought tidying was a lot to do about discarding things. But actually, I felt so stressful about it. And then one day, I fell on the floor. And then this experience taught me a very important thing. So the tidying is not about discarding things, but actually finding the items that spark joy in you, what brings you happiness.
And so that's obviously at the core of your philosophy. Can you tell us then about your method?
There are two major parts of my method. It's very clear. The first one is to select only the items that spark joy in you. Ask yourself the question, does it spark joy? That's a very important question. The second part is that to do it in one go. So say, for instance, if it's clothes, collect everything, every single piece of clothes in one spot, and then start tidying. And so it is done by category, not by location.
Now, once you've done that and you've achieved a tidy house, it's really important to keep it up. And I love the way that in the book you describe your walk from the door, from the minute you get home, to when you can, 5 minutes later, relax. And I wonder if you could take us through that process and what you do in that time.
Yes, it is a routine. You could say that, I think. When I go home every day after working, I say thank you to each item that I have used today. And then by saying it, as I say it, I'll put it away in the designated spot for each item. Think about it like this. When you go home, you want to wind down and relax. Things are the same. They're going back to their designated place. They're going to relax that way.
With this book, obviously, you've toured all over the world. Have you found that the way that we tidy and the way we relate to objects, obviously, varies in different countries and in different cultures?
As I visit different countries, the problems that an individual has, say, for instance, I find it very difficult to discard things. I find it very difficult to let go of things. That sort of problems is personal, and then that is universal, pretty much the same. What's different, on the other hand, is that the space, how large the house is, for example, and then the structure of a house, and then about storage, can be different. And especially, this is something that I have noticed recently, that in Europe, people have enormous respect towards heirloom, or something that's passed down generations to them. They have a huge respect towards these things, probably more than what I have seen in Japan.
In the book, you write that once you've decluttered your home, that declutters your mind too, and that it can really help people in their everyday life. So I'm wondering if that method of clearing your brain works. Can it do the same for your inbox? Can you work this on your digital devices?
Yes, same thing can be said about inbox as well, digital things. So by tidying up, you will know clearly, okay, what you really need to keep in personal computer. It will clarify your mind as well.
Your second book, Spark Joy, has just come out. This is a companion illustrated guide.
Yes, it is to answer the frequently asked questions and also the problems that they encounter as they go through. So it is based on people who have done it, but they might not have completed. So by illustration of how to fold, that will clarify where they tripped, for example, and also that there are many questions that often I am asked. So that is, this book is answering those.
Now, I can imagine this working when you live alone in an apartment, perhaps. But I live in a house, we're a family, we've got dogs, cats, visitors in and out all of the time. It's not easy. It's very different from living a Spartan life in a clean apartment on your own.
Yes, precisely. It becomes more difficult than when you are living by yourself in a flat. But the basics doesn't change. It's always start with your own things, tidy up your things before you think about, oh, my family members are messy. It's going to be so difficult. And then this is a very magical thing. This tidying actually ripples through. Your family members start to tidy up for themselves without being nagged. And also that you have completed your tidying means you know what to do. What are the key points? You can teach them properly. So that way, the whole house will be tidied in the end.
Now, I know that you have a baby. So has that changed the way that your own method works for you?
At the moment, my daughter is only 6 months old, so she hasn't really reached the age that is going to clutter everywhere. But even by her birth, I am quite surprised how much stuff the babies need. So I think the true challenge is going to come when she is big enough to clutter.
Interesting. Finally, I know that people credit you with changing their lives, that your method really, really can alter people's mindset. And I know that you've come across a lot of really uplifting stories from people as you travel the world, people who've adopted your method. And I wondered if there were a few of those you'd like to tell us.
There are many anecdotes, as you said, but one of them that I find significantly changed her life. She couldn't tidy up at all. And then at that time, she was in a kind of negative personal relationship as well. And she didn't know what to do with it, really. But through this tidying process, she realized that she actually finds spark joy in tidying itself. That was very new to her. And now it is her profession. And then through this, all this process really clarified, make everything clear about herself. And then she could clarify what she thought and what she wanted about this relationship. And then she's got married now. So everything is clear about her life now. When I hear a story like that, I feel so delighted.
That was Marie Kondo, the author of The Life-Changing Magic of Tidying and the follow-up illustrated companion volume Spark Joy, both on sale absolutely everywhere now. Alexander Hemon is the Bosnian-born author of the award-winning book The Lazarus Project and three collections of short stories. His latest novel is The Making of Zombie Wars. Born in Sarajevo, Hemon visited Chicago in 1992, intending to stay for a matter of months. While he was there, Sarajevo came under siege, and he was unable to return home. Hemon wrote his first story in English in 1995, and he's been garnering praise and winning awards for his work ever since. He was given a Guggenheim Fellowship and a Genius Grant from the MacArthur Foundation. Alexander, what exactly is a Genius Grant?
Well, MacArthur Foundation gives out these fellowships once a year to some 20 to 25 people of all areas of human interest and work, and those are unconditional, and you cannot really apply for them. In fact, nominations and selection process is anonymous. In other words, they call you out of the blue, which is what they did to me some 10 years ago. And I thought I was being called by a debt collector, so I was somewhat reluctant to respond. But the grant, the fellowship is unconditional in that it doesn't have to be justified by any particular project, nor do you have to show anything for it at the end of the term, which is 5 years. It just allows people to pursue their interest and curiosity in any direction they wish.
That's extraordinary. But as you say, it's expired now, so does that mean you're not a genius anymore?
No, I'm back to stupid, yes.
We were also discussing the subject of biographies because, of course, there are so many biographies of various well-known people, including yourself, out there. Wikipedia is obviously always the most misleading one, but various ones in different various forms. You were talking about just making it up, though, really.
Well, I met an Italian poet, and I had not read his biographies, but as they were introducing him, they at some festival, in fact, in Slovenia, we were told that he makes up his biographies, imaginary biographies, and places them in various places. So they're competing, but they're all in equally false. And now that obviously mystifies the notion of biography. And they're very funny, too. They read one of them. When I was listening to one of those false biographies, I realized I should have done this. Why didn't I think of that?
Well, it's amazing how it gets repeated and repeated. I interviewed someone the other day who, on his Wikipedia entry, it says he always carries a loaded firearm. And everywhere he goes now, that follows him. And he says he's quite pleased, actually. It makes him feel quite safe. Safety, of course, is something that has loomed huge in your life because you were born in Sarajevo. Really interesting to look at that trajectory from man in Sarajevo to the successful writer living in Chicago. And I'm really interested to find out how that came about, particularly starting with your early work in radio in Sarajevo.
Yes, I'm a fan of radio. I started as a writer and as a reporter at a radio station, which was geared toward young people. It was called the Youth Program in Bosnia, obviously. And so young people, I was in my early 20s then, and most of my friends and colleagues, other than one or two bosses, were just the same age, some of them younger. And we started from scratch. I had no radio training. We were trained on the job. And we were experimenting with various things. At some point, I was writing short stories that I would read on air, and that would be, you know, under 3 minutes long, a couple of pages. So that is a formative experience for me in many ways than one. But it also started me on this trajectory of journalism, although I was always inclined toward making stuff up, and I was not comfortable sticking to the facts. So, which is to say that I had always wanted to write fiction, write literature. And at some point, I published things in Bosnia and former Yugoslavia before the war. But I was invited to visit the United States in the early part of 1992 as a young journalist, kind of a cultural exchange, which lasted for a month. And then I had asked this agency, which no longer exists, the United States Information Agency, to allow me to stay a little longer to visit some friends. In Canada, I went to Canada and went back to the United States to see a friend in Chicago. And I was in Chicago when the war in Bosnia started. In fact, I was supposed to fly back from Chicago to Sarajevo on May 1st, 1992, and the siege started on May 2nd, 1992. I would have landed just in time for the siege. So I didn't fly back, so I live in Chicago now.
And you must have watched the whole thing unfolding with horror from far away, not being able to do a thing.
Right, exactly. And I had, it was difficult to stay in touch with friends and people. My family left Sarajevo on May 2nd, in fact, and they roamed around Bosnia and former Yugoslavia until they made it to Canada in December 1993. My sister subsequently moved back to Sarajevo and then from Sarajevo to London, which is where she lives now.
Now, one of your professors from your university in Sarajevo, somebody who had been a mentor to you, was actually involved in the wrong side in the war. He was a man who it would seem, was responsible directly for a lot of the genocide. Now, this is something you've written about in one of your books.
Right. My professor, Nikola Kojic, who was my favorite professor, the only writing class I've ever taken was his class on writing essays. I graduated in 1990, and he was my thesis mentor, one of my mentors, which was, the thesis was on Ulysses, Joyce's Ulysses. But we had stayed in touch. We stayed in touch after my graduation, and after I started working as a journalist, and after I joined the Serbian Nationalist Fascist Party, headed by Radovan Karadžić, I would actually go to press conferences where he would sit next to Radovan Karadžić, and who was very, you know, projects violence outwardly, even before the war. And there would be this little tweedy, thick-glassed professor of mine who would give me advice after the press conference saying, stick to literature. Subsequently, he was one of the leaders of the Serbian Nationalist Party, and they all ran the genocidal operations in Bosnia. I mean, not the military part of it, obviously, but the political part of it. He shot himself in 1997 after he had been removed from those realms of power by Karadžić for some reason or another, I don't really know. His presence in my life forced me to rethink my positions on literature and culture and what it all means, because I used to think that it was literature and culture and art was a haven from to which we retreat from the ugliness of history and the filth of politics. In other words, it's a form of moral inoculation against, you know, war and genocide and bloodthirstiness and all that. But his story destroyed that notion for me. So,
and what do you think now?
Well, I mean, if I didn't think that it's worth something to write and that literature is worth something, I wouldn't be doing it. But I don't think it has this moral value that can be transferred by mere exposure. In other words, you can listen to all the Beethoven you want in your life or read Shakespeare and still be a genocidal killer. But it is a field in which we enter as writers and readers and look for those who can connect us in ways that we do not have available elsewhere. It's a field of knowledge that is not available otherwise. So it doesn't, in other words, if there's moral value in it, it has to be mined by the individual person, but it's not inherent in the thing as such.
Your story and your individual story and the story of your professor and various other parts of your life, you've brought together in a book, in a form of short stories, but you famously said that you don't write autobiography.
I don't, because to me, the process of literature, simply put, is the transference of personal into the public and then getting the feedback from the public, and the circulation from the personal to the public is what is interesting to me, because the thing with literature is that it uses the most public thing of all, which is language. It's available to everyone who speaks it and reads it. So I find words as a writer, as do many other writers, to express or deal with innermost things, but then as they're being transferred to the public, they're being transformed. At the same time, as I'm entering the public space, I find things there that I do not possess personally, say stories that come to me, or I mine them from this field, or people tell me, or I just assemble them in that field. So that by the time I have written the book, I am in some ways everything in the book, everyone and everything. And so my presence that was initially personal, or details that had personal meaning to me, have moved into a realm that does not belong to me. And in that transition, those things are transformed.
You talk about language, and what's really extraordinary about you is that you learned English as an adult and started writing these amazing books in your second language.
I studied English as a kid, but it was cool. I wasn't too enthusiastic about this. And so when I arrived in the United States, I could communicate, but for instance, I seldom used articles. Slavic languages have no articles, so it's a faculty that every Slavic language speaker has to develop. What I didn't have is a language that one uses to write. It's an entirely different, higher, arguably, register of language. So you cannot approximate. You have to use the articles. And so I needed to develop that. And I did that by way of reading compulsively, which is the way, really, that any writer in their native language acquires that register of language.
Mm. You've been compared to Nabokov, to Conrad, all these people that wrote in a second language.
Well, it's flattering, but, it's far-fetched. Nabokov wrote 40 books, and he was a genius in both of those languages. He also had an English nanny, and so his first words were, in fact, in English. So his father was so concerned about him and his brother that they had to hire a Russian tutor.
It's extraordinary. One of your parents is Ukrainian.
My father is of Ukrainian, from a Ukrainian-speaking family, but he was born in Bosnia. Bosnia is one of those spaces in the world, in fact, many spaces like that, where people of all backgrounds mingled. So my grandparents were born in what is now Ukraine, but back then was Galicia, or Galicia, the easternmost province of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. So they moved within the borders of the empire when they got to Bosnia. On my mother's side, the family has been Bosnian for many generations. But on my father's side, the family is bilingual. Most of my family on my father's side is in Canada now, and they use both Bosnian and Ukrainian at home. But because my mother is not Ukrainian, we didn't really speak Ukrainian at home.
Where do you feel you belong?
Oh, I belong in my books, for one thing, but I take both Chicago and Sarajevo to be my hometowns, and I'm pretty comfortable in both of them, although obviously I live in Chicago.
You've written really interestingly about assimilation and how often perhaps it's not the greatest thing.
Well, I don't like assimilation as a term because it means that I dissolve into the new environment and become what is there. I think that the situation of immigration has changed substantially in the past 50 years, perhaps, and now we're seeing another set of changes. My presence in the United States changes the country. The presence of immigrants changes the country, I think, for the better. And in that exchange, you know, everyone gets something. I'm not assimilated because I write in Bosnian and English. I participate in both of those spaces. It is possible because of the internet and the cheap transportation and many other things. And so it allows me to, and I'm not the only one doing it, everyone in that situation, a similar situation is doing it, to be simultaneously present to some extent in both of those spaces, thereby changing both of the spaces. So in other words, you can kiss the melting pot goodbye. I have not melted.
How important is music to you when you write?
I have a very difficult time writing without music. I usually write with earphones on. It's very loud. And, you know, in a long day, that means that I might be listening to 8 hours of music continuously while writing. It's probably damaging my hearing. It has damaged my hearing. But it's not so much that it blocks off the sounds of the world around me. I can block that off by, you know, intense concentration. It is rather that music stimulates a part of my brain that is different from the thinking, the language part. And it is the part of the brain that is interested in the rhythm and sound. And so I think that my sentences are stiffer if I don't listen to music. Obviously, I edit sentences after I write the first version, so I can adjust them to have the rhythm and the music in them even, you know, in more than one try. But the music stimulates my brain in a way that I'm now addicted to, and it's very difficult for me not to hear music while I'm writing.
And when you're writing in English, which wasn't your original tongue, is there a particular beat to that?
Well, English has its own rhythms. It's a different syntax. The sentences are differently organized. The Slavic languages, including Bosnian, are inflectional, which means that, you know, you can deduce the subject of the sentence from the verb inflection, which allows for syntactic flexibility, and you can move things around. And so it's, in some ways, it's more musical and more flexible for that. But English has different demands. It has far more words available because it's a larger language, more people speak it. It's a longer history of publication in it. So in English, you know, Shakespeare is available to me. In Bosnian, not quite.
What about other stimulation while you're writing?
Coffee.
I'm not asking about your drug habits.
No, I don't have them, but if I did, I would be happy to talk about it. Maybe next time I'll develop them by next time. It's coffee. Coffee I need to get a morning jolt with coffee.
And you watch a lot of movies.
Yes, I do. When I was a journalist, a young journalist, I was a film critic. It was a terrible one, but still I watched a lot of them. And I still watch a lot of film and think about it. I also read a lot, obviously, and various things from, you know, biographies to nonfiction history books and poetry and all kinds of fiction. If I'm terribly lonely, if there's nothing to read. Hell is being at an airport without a book.
You don't find it distracts you? You can read other people while you're writing yourself?
Of course. I mean, people have different methods. But to me, if I were to exclude reading when I'm writing, I would never read anything, for one thing. But it also, it's reading as writing is a dialogue. I do not presume that if I read Nabokov that I would start writing like Nabokov. Mm. If I read Shakespeare that I would suddenly start writing in pentameter and I would not be able to stop it. I mean, that's ridiculous. But reading and the sounds of those sentences, the thoughts, they're stimulating to me. I enter this dialogue with writers or imaginary readers, and this circulation of ideas and languages is what I feed on.
Back to movies, and I know you do find them very stimulating, that perhaps they're a source of inspiration. Well, this book, The Making of Zombie Wars, is all about a scriptwriter. Give us the brief plot. I love the way that it's a comic novel, but it's really not.
Well, yes, I like to write complicated books in that they, you know, defy expectations up to a point. The main character is Joshua Levin, who's an English as a second language teacher, but has ambition to write screenplays. He has a hard time finishing any of his screenplays, in fact, going beyond the initial idea. So he has trouble making decisions. However, he slips into an affair with one of his English as second language students, a Bosnian woman who's married and has a child. And then subsequently, he has all kinds of problems because of that bad choice.
And the zombies are not the kind of zombies. I mean, this goes beyond your normal movie script.
He develops an interest in zombies, and as his adventures unfold, he stays with his zombie idea. But the shape of the script, and there are excerpts from the script throughout the book, changes. In other words, the main hero develops, but also his situations are not predictable in a number of ways. And until it becomes clear, I hope, that the main hero was a hero, unlike Joshua, is a kind of a projection of Joshua, who he would like to be, but never quite makes it there, so that the script becomes Joshua's fantasy of himself.
And a comment on the American dream?
It is a comment on the American way of dreaming. In America, this notion that you can invent yourself, it's appealing in many ways, but also that means you can deny the essence of your being and just pretend that you didn't do what you had done, which is, you know, problematic ethically and morally. So that after countries invaded, we can pretend that they didn't quite do it, or that we can enter war and then pretend that we didn't lose it. That is something that I have trouble with.
That was Alexander Hemon. His latest book is The Making of Zombie Wars. It's published by Pan Macmillan. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Meet the Writers. Join us again to listen live at the same time next week, or subscribe to the SoundCloud channel for free and never miss an episode. Thanks to the production team of Toby Hammond, Weidong Lin, Claire Urban and Federica Romaniello. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thanks very much for listening, and goodbye.